Blog Talk Radio.
What do you know? What do you know? What do you know?
The birds and the bees are wise to the light.
What do you know?
So they took to the trees and took to the sky.
What do you know?
On top of the chain and safe from the rain.
What do you know?
What you know about the ways of the underside?
What do you know?
I bought a hot shot get from an old Van Guinea.
What do you know?
Cause they're hip to the moon and hip to the light.
What do you know?
And yep, but the ass cause you ain't got a penny.
What do you know?
What you know about the ways on the underside?
What do you know?
One hot shot cat from a North Bank Guinea.
What do you know?
Ain't it up with your ass cause you ain't got a penny.
What do you know?
Dropping bombs from above cut you all down to size.
What do you know?
Cause the hip to the ball and the hip to the rise.
What do you know?
Yeah, the street throws in two perfect ways in the night.
What do you know?
One crashes on my left and one on my right. It's all fire and brimstone, baby, so let's go outside.
What do you know?
It's all fire and brimstone, baby. I got my brand new pistol, baby.
What do you know?
One hot shot cat from a North Bay Guinea.
I can't hit that key, Darb. Like, not at all.
Okay.
Nowhere close. Couldn't hit the key. So anyway. Hello and welcome to Logicast. Logicast is a weekly podcast. And we discuss issues such as history, science, skepticism, religion, politics. Sometimes we delve into economics. This week we're going to be talking about mythicism and pseudo-history. We've been on a hiatus for, I said 3 weeks. It was probably like closer to a month, right?
Yeah, it's been a while.
It's been a while. I missed you. I really have.
Yeah, me too.
You've missed you too?
You know what I meant.
I do. I do know what you meant. So, let's get through the pleasantries real quick. In fact, I'm just going to answer for you. I'm going to say, Darby, how were your holidays? Were they great? You're going to say yes in a sort of flabbergasted tone. I'm going to take that as you're glad they're over, and then I'm going to agree with you, and then we can move on.
That sounds good to me.
Okay, perfect.
Well, I probably
excellent.
Wouldn't have said great, but they happened, and they were fine.
Mine were pretty good. I mean, I got to spend Thanksgiving with my aunt and uncle, and that was great. I haven't seen them in a long time, and they got to meet my wife, so that was wonderful. I spent Christmas with my brother and his wife and their two children, and my own mom, which was phenomenal, which is relevant. I mean, my mom lives like a mile away. So I see her all the time. And then I got to spend New Year's with my father-in-law and my mother-in-law. Father-in-law is a wonderful man. Very brilliant, by the way. I mean, I know you've read a lot of books, and I've read quite a few books. But that man is literally, you know, dived into probably over 2,000 books. I mean, his library is incredible, and he's read every single book in his library. I mean, it's truly, truly amazing.
That is impressive.
It is. It's very. Now, granted, he's you know, sort of getting up there in age. So, I mean, it's, you know, he's retired. So he has the time to devote to reading books. But my wife also reads a lot, so I think that's probably where she gets it from. And, you know, we obviously want our children to to read a bunch when they, number one, are born, and number two, get of age to read. So, have you been following this thing that happened in Paris?
Yeah.
And I want to get your thoughts on it. What do you think? How do you feel?
Well, I mean, probably about like you'd expect. I'm horrified. I'm not surprised. I expected the sort of shitstorm that happened afterwards, where you get a bunch of people from both sides of the crowds that usually show up after these kind of events making blanket pronouncements about one thing or another. And I read a statement from one of the guys that was killed that I found quite compelling, where he said, I don't know how long ago it was, a few months maybe, where he said that he was already under police protection, and he said he didn't have a wife or any kids, and he cared a lot about what he was doing, and he believed that extremism should be available for criticism and for mocking, just like everything else. And he'd rather live like that than die cowering before the extremists that he felt deserved to be in the same pool as everybody else, which means your ideas are not beyond any criticism or any mockery. But they decided that their response to that would be to shoot him in the head.
Yeah, so you know that there was a Muslim cop who was also killed, right? Who was actually executed on the street. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Yeah, and I'm not going to try to butcher his name. You can Google him, but you know, but he was a cop, and you know, he was a French police officer, from what I understand, and you know, he, you know, responded to the call that day, and they, you know, there's actually a picture of them executing him, you know, in broad daylight on the street. So, very upsetting, very pathetic and horrible and ridiculous loss of life, unnecessary loss of life. And, you know, trying to make sense of it any time we do attempt to make sense of such heinous acts. You know, it's always very difficult to find relevant justification. There is no relevant justification, but trying to understand how they would believe it's relevant justification in taking the lives of people who said bad things about their religion. It's very difficult.
I try to lead with compassion with my fellow human beings. Actually, it's hard when you can't empathize. It's very hard when you can't understand, oh, yeah, I can see how you might feel that way. I can't. I can't see that. So it's really hard. It's a hard stretch for me. I don't understand it.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't imagine believing in something so much that I was willing to kill another person because they disagreed. Like, I don't have that in me. I would be willing to wager that almost all skeptics feel the same way. You know, sort of just a personal kind of hypothesis, I guess. Can't speak for everyone, but I could never imagine killing someone because we had a disagreement, because there was a conversation we would have that would cause me to think the only possible response I could give to this person is to take their life. I couldn't even fathom that.
No, I don't. Especially since the response is to not you've made specific verbal threats against my children, right? Or you've made,
right.
I mean, one can imagine reacting with fear and protectiveness against that kind of thing. But not slaughtering people, sorry. But I can't understand. You make cartoons that I think are mean, about something that I take very seriously. And that's what we're talking about. And I understand that part of the reason I understand it is because I was not indoctrinated in that tradition. There is a major gulf between me and somebody who can say, like, no, you have no right to insult the prophet, who can't even say the name without that, like, this little sycophantic, you know, verbal tick, which I'm sure sounds very unkind, but that's exactly what it is. Because the superstition is just has gone so far into every aspect. I can't relate to that. So that's fair. If someone leveled that at me, it's true. I can't relate to it. I don't understand it.
You know, one of the things that I would like to kind of comment on, and I've seen this a lot through the blogosphere and on Twitter and on Facebook for sure. It's very difficult for people who don't believe, whether they don't believe in Islam specifically as a religion, to, I think, comprehend that it's not about the cartoon itself, right? Like, to Muslims, it's a much deeper meaning. Like, we see it as you killed someone over a cartoon, or you killed someone over a satirical piece. How ridiculous are you? I mean, to them, it is, to extremists and fundamentalists, it is everything. I mean, it is, you know, to insult their religion is, you know, to them, I think, to commit some sort of unforgivable harm. And they're taught these things. I mean, I mean, nobody wakes up one day and they just say, you know, I'm going to go kill someone because they made a cartoon, you know, that disparaged something that I believe strongly in. I mean, they are indoctrinated with this, like you said. And they, you know, are raised inside of a community and inside of a culture that, you know, that supports this ideology, at least supports it more than opposes it, which, you know, does cause, you know, sort of systemic problems like this. You know, it's just what we have to deal with. And the fact of the matter is that I actually ran into a friend of mine, yesterday afternoon, someone I haven't seen in a while, and he told me that he felt like this is why, he's a Christian, by the way, but he said this is why he believes that Islam as a religion should be banned. And I, you know, kind of pointed out that the vast majority of Muslims are obviously not violent. Whether or not Islam itself promotes violence, which I think it does. To a certain extent, I think all Abrahamic religions to some extent promote violence, right? I mean, it's the idea of inclusion.
It's in there.
You know, yeah.
It's
the idea of inclusivity only. And and with regard to the tribe or with regard to the culture that believes it. And I pointed out that the same justifications could have been given right up until about 200 years ago, for Christianity to be sort of banned as well. So we don't need to have conversations about banning religion. I don't believe in banning religion. I think that's completely and totally absurd. The best way that you deal with problems such as that, such as, you know, issues with regard to extremism is that you are more proactive about, you know, ensuring that extremists do not, you know, populate and propagate inside of your community. I could go on a long spiel about how I feel about the war on terror practically and, you know, why I see some utility inside of it. Because war on terror is not just something that has happened in America. It's also, you know, happened with many of our allies have also partaken in it. So there's a lot of conversations that need to be had about what we're willing to accept and what can and should happen. But I don't think that banning religion is a particularly good idea. And I think personally, I think that it's deplorable. I personally believe that people should have the right to put whatever they want in their minds. I think they should have the right to worship however they want. in whatever private area they want, whether it's their home or their church or synagogue or mosque. And I may not agree with their religion, but I absolutely believe that they have the right to practice it. And I might not have agreed with some of the cartoons. I'm not saying that's my position. Not at all. I think that, you know, satire is absolutely wonderful. Yeah, I mean, I think mockery is absolutely necessary and criticism is necessary if you want to live in a free society. Well, that's what you get.
That's right. And it's worth it. It serves a purpose and we need it.
It is, and it does serve a purpose, and we do need it, because the only way that you can, for one, there's nothing, I've always had this opinion about beliefs, and if your belief should not be criticized, and that should be, you know, or if you're told that your belief should not be criticized, then that should be your first reason to question it.
Yep.
I mean, you know. Personally, is the way I believe. I think it was an atrocious and ridiculous and pointless loss of life over nothing. And, you know, Ricky Gervais actually, you know, on his Twitter said, why exactly is it that if God is all-powerful and all-knowing that he needs other people to kill human beings for him? Like, you think he would be able to do that on his own?
Yeah, and why is someone who is the final prophet of the one true God so easy to offend to the point where slaughter becomes necessary?
Right.
Honestly, you'd think that would be a position of great security.
Well, you know, it's like when I speak to Christians and they talk to me about forgiveness and, you know, yeah, you know, you're an atheist now, but you can actually come back to Jesus. And you know, normally I ask them what their doctrine is on blasphemy. And a lot of people don't realize this, but it's pretty well interpreted and pretty well demonstrated that blasphemy is pretty much an unforgivable sin inside of, you know, to deny Jesus Christ being God, at least the way that the Christian churches, both Protestants and Catholics, have translated this throughout the years and have interpreted this and, you know, then delivered it in sermons to others, you know, that that it is one of the unforgivable sins to say, for example, that, you know, Jesus Christ is sort of not Lord, you know, that he's not the Savior. And I've said that on multiple occasions. So, you know, according to your own doctrine, which, by the way, many of you have not read, many of them have not read anyway, you know, I'm not going to heaven no matter what, so why the fuck would I stop now? But blasphemy is very much ingrained inside of the Abrahamic religions. There are a lot of really good historical reasons for why that's the case. Not that it is justifiable by any stretch of the imagination, but there's a reason why they, you know, many of them believe that and said that. You know, most people don't even realize that suicide, for example, was actually pretty popular in early Christianity. Did you know that?
What do you mean, early Christianity?
I mean, in like pretty much right up until about the 4th or 5th century, it was actually a pretty popular. It's actually a pretty popular route for people to take. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and then after that, you have people who are desperate to martyr themselves. And then, and that's another form of sort of suiciding, right?
Yeah.
Because
and it's really interesting because, you know, Islam sort of took positions of Christianity and kind of expanded on them, and martyrdom actually became a bit more appealing. Martyrdom's not really very appealing in Christianity in the sense that you go kill other people in order to get into heaven. Like, you won't really find that anywhere in, you know, Christian doctrine or in the New Testament.
Right.
You definitely find that in the Quran. And, you know, it was actually one of the things that, you know, separates Islam from Christianity, and very difficult to turn people into martyrs when the book has no real comment on martyrdom, and in fact basically says it's okay to die for your faith, but, you know, thou shalt not kill. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, you know. Okay. So moving on. Let's talk about your favorite topic. This is the way I wanted to start the new year, by the way, was fucking with you.
Great.
You sound thrilled.
I'm so thrilled. Well, actually, can I say something first that's related to this that I've been thinking about
recently? Go ahead.
I would like to talk about the human, and I know some people would say, oh, this is a Christian thing, but it sure is not just a Christian thing or just a religious thing. It is a very human thing, but I will say I think it's even more specifically an American thing, which is the desperate and frantic need to be right at all costs. And this is a terrible affliction to have if you're a skeptic, because if you're a good skeptic, you're going to be wrong, sometimes a lot. And that's actually not a bad thing. The idea that you should not admit when you're wrong or that you refuse to look at any other information that might prove you wrong and instead you're just going to freak out and bluster and insult the person that suggests it makes you a poor skeptic, but it also doesn't make you seem right or smart or like you have the upper hand, even though I think that's the idea that people have. And so I've been in several arguments recently with absolutely intractable people who refuse to even answer basic questions, which, of course, Jared will remind me, and he is right. It is not useful to engage with people who can't talk to you in any sort of, I'm wasting my time with people if they refuse to address points or answer questions. But this idea that, I'm right, and it's even more dangerous than a skeptic because it's sort of assumed, or sometimes it just goes along with it as a separate thing. Confirmation bias is a terrible problem for everybody but me. It's a terrible problem for religious people, especially, ha-ha, those fucking idiots. And, of course, both you and I recoil when people say that because, of course, it's not true that all religious people are fucking idiots. It is becoming more clear to me that it's true that a lot of people of every ilk are fucking idiots. But that's just me having a bad day.
Well, it doesn't.
The point is.
Right. I mean, sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. It's just, it's a dangerous place to be in, to call yourself a skeptic, refuse to analyze information, entrench yourself in this idea that you're right, even when you've only read one side of an argument, and then react by lashing out and grabbing the torch to swing at people when they, bring up other things. And if you're, in a conversation with me, I don't remember the last time I brought something up and insulted someone for not knowing it, or brought someone up and made them feel stupid because their point wasn't really valid. I'm actually a really respectful person to have conversations with. And when I'm wrong, I just admit that I'm wrong. And if you think about it, if you think about the people that you've seen go, oh, my God, you're right. I had that wrong. my bad. You have more or less respect for that person. No one's doing themselves any favors by pretending they're right all the time. And you win nothing. You lose. You end up being a loser in that conversation because you have failed to exercise your skepticism. And you have decided that confirmation bias is a problem for everybody but you. And that's a disaster.
Yeah, and I mean, especially with regard to confirmation bias. For example, you and I call each other out on things, I think, all the time. You've corrected me, I've corrected you. I mean, obviously, we have we have different deliveries when it comes to dealing with people. I've actually adopted more of your sort of delivery, if only because I realize that if I actually want to have a conversation with someone and try to convince them that they might be wrong, that being a dick to them is only going to turn them off from having a rational conversation. And what I've noticed is you have groups of people who fashion themselves as the next sort of Christopher Hitchens, or, you know, they've spent far too much time watching, you know, Dr. House be a complete douchebag on a fictional television show. And, you know, they're like, yeah, you know, I'm going to be this sort of interesting asshole. And not to say that I always necessarily behave myself. Sometimes I get frustrated. And, you know, but the fact of the matter is that every wrong thing I've learned, or everything I've learned that I've been wrong about, helps get me closer to the actual truth. Right. So I welcome that. And even with regard to how I run my business, for example, a lot of it comes down to being able to, you know, accept and listen to criticism. I train my employees to listen to criticism. You know, we have open conversations about which policies and which procedures work for them and what they do and which ones don't, which ones we need to abandon, how we need to adapt, because I think that's what a, you know, responsible, intelligent, rational person does. I think there's this idea that skepticism is sort of a, just like everything else, it's a pathway to finding truth in everything, and that's not what it is at all. And I think that that's kind of part of the problem is you have people calling themselves skeptics who are not actually skeptics. I mean, they're either promoting, you know, many that I've seen promote, you know, sort of what the scientific consensus says, you know, we'll do some research and then we'll parrot the scientific consensus as being their justification for why they accept it. Vaccines and GMOs are, you know, good examples. Now, it doesn't mean that they're wrong, obviously. I think that they're absolutely right, and we can only go by what the evidence states. Interestingly enough, many of these same people call themselves skeptics. When you bring up points that disagree with their bias, their current bias inside of the ideology they might find themselves in, they side with the ideology and ignore the facts, which I think is actually a good segue into what we're going to talk about tonight. So, do you want to get started and vent your frustrations, or do you want me to go?
No, you can go ahead. I'll jump in. You know I will.
Okay. So we talked about mythicism before, and it seems to keep kind of coming up. And I think that some of you might wonder why we, you know, continue to talk about it. Obviously, we did have David Fitzgerald on the show. I think both Darby and I like David. I've had good conversation with David. He's the kind of guy that I would invite over to my house for dinner, and I'd be willing to wager that we would have a great time.
I'm very fond of David. I think he's a smart guy, and I like him a lot personally. So I'm just chiming in agreeing with you.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think so too. I've grown as I've come to talk to David more. I've grown very fond of him. The problem is that I think that David is wrong, and unfortunately, and this is sort of multifaceted, so I'm going to have to kind of unpack this, you know, in a way that everyone understands. I take issue with mythicism because it is not supported by historical consensus. And before I'm accused of, you know, using an argument from authority, I would only like to point out that the most ardent supporters of scientific consensus, by the way, in my experience anyway, and this is only anecdotal, tend to be other atheists. Now you have scientifically minded Christians and Muslims and Jews, you know, and Hindus and Buddhists and, you know, people who understand science and understand what the current scientific consensus is and understand the justification behind the consensus. What ends
and
up happening
Can I just butt in for 1 second before?
Sure.
Also relevant is that the logical fallacy, and pretty much anywhere you look this up, of argument for authority is about bringing up an authority that is either not an authority or that is irrelevant to the case. Any thing will tell you that the argument for authority fallacy is misapplied if you try to use it to discredit expertise consensus. That's actually not what it's about. So saying there's a consensus in this field of study that says this, and here are the reasons, et cetera, that is not an argument from authority, which I know you know, but just clarifying that. So keep going.
Right. So the misapplication of the argument from authority is, you know, happens quite often during these conversations when we discuss mythicism. And, you know, really what it is sort of ironic, because the argument from authority, whenever they cite certain personalities, certain credentialed people, I won't say personalities, I'll say certain credentialed people, actually the argument, they're the ones utilizing the argument from authority.
Right. And often these are the same skeptics that will laugh off an anti-vax person by saying scientific consensus is pretty much unanimous on this point, that vaccines do not cause autism, are good for you, they are necessary, especially if you're going to Disneyland. This stuff is all the time comes out of skeptics' mouth. Climate change, vaccinations, whatever. And they're used to doing it about science. But history, there is actually a method of doing history, and it is not random. So it's a very similar thing to just decide, these experts don't know shit about anything, and they're not really experts. Or another argument, which I've heard recently, there aren't any experts because nobody really studies Jesus, because they're afraid the Christians will heap scorn upon them if they say that Jesus never existed. That was actually something that got brought up to me, and I still can't believe it did. And as I said to you, the immediate image came into my head of, like, people running out of Oxford in their black robes, like, don't bring that up, the Christians will come and make fun of us. I mean, this is an outrageous and extraordinary claim that everybody working in classical history is afraid, and so therefore does not really have an opinion about this, because they're afraid. What are you afraid of? Christian scorn?
Well,
I don't know. Anyway, please continue.
Part of what happens is, and it's not that there's no legitimacy to some of the arguments. So, you know, Jesus was treated as a legitimate figure for many years, you know, not based on a lot of, you know, what we would consider today to be legitimate historical research. There's some legitimacy in that statement. Some.
Sure,
I'm not going to spend the entire time. Correct.
Right, we have all this overblown stuff from historians 200 years ago, and we all sort of kept, you know, skating along on that, whereas actual historians were realizing, oh, this is a bunch of English people who hated the Spanish, and they were exaggerating this crap,
right,
and so now they figured out. But that doesn't mean the Inquisition didn't happen.
Well, there are...
It was exaggerated, you know what I mean?
Well, there are and were points throughout history, specifically throughout the history of Christianity, where it was just assumed that Jesus actually existed, and...
of course there was.
You know, it was given, you know, such a large amount of credence that there was no question, because it couldn't be questioned, because you didn't have history being practiced the way it is practiced today.
Right.
In the past, we'll say probably 125, 150 years, which obviously everything just gets better, usually gets better over time. You know, as technology advances and as our understanding advances, as our education specifically gets better. You know, so it's not that there's no legitimacy to that argument, but what happens is that argument is used to demonstrate that it, you know, we're used as a supposition to assert that there can't be consensus because there was this bias. Problem is that the bias is relegated to that period of history. And that now we have all this other evidence, or we have separate evidence that has been, you know, measured objectively, or at least more objectively, by different scholars in, you know, different eras that have come to the conclusion happens to agree to a certain extent with what the bias says. But that doesn't mean that the bias necessarily caused the, you know, the consensus. And the opinion in a lot of mythicist circles seems to be that the bias from, for example, the early Catholic Church and moving on from the early Catholic Church, you know, that the bias actually caused the consensus to occur, and that's not the way it works. And if you believe that, you don't understand history. You don't understand the, you know, the historical method. I mean, you know, how conclusions are reached inside of historical circles.
Right.
And, you know, and one of the things that really irks me the most is that is used today in today's society as being justification. I mean, we have atheists and Jews and, you know, people self-proclaimed agnostics and Christians and Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists, all of whom are historians, all of whom agree that Jesus of Nazareth actually existed. So it seems very weird to try to use this as a, you know, as an argument against historicity for Jesus, when it's quite obvious that all these people weren't manipulated by Christianity, by a devout belief in Jesus as being this, you know, it's completely absurd.
It's just beyond. It makes me angry to even hear about it. And it's not that this subject itself, this tiny subject, it doesn't matter. Christianity is stupid. It makes no sense whether Jesus lived or not. That's not the point of this. The point of this is that misapplied skepticism and entrenching yourself in an idea because it already goes along with what you think, or you think it's going to give you some ability to mic drop on a Christian and go, aha, your guy never even existed. And therefore, you ignore everything about the expertise in an established field, about academia, about this. You're really showing no respect for history as a pursuit.
Discipline, yeah.
And thank you. That's a better word. You're blowing. It is an amazing thing. It is really like an anti-vaccine thing. Big Pharma is paying you off. That's why the Australian government won't let this whack job in to talk about her stuff, because they're trying to hide the truth. Well, in that case, you at least have a gigantic money-making string of private corporations that could theoretically do that. Of course, there's no evidence that they are. But in the case of, like, you know, as I said to David once, Big Jesus, who is Big Jesus? I mean, the idea is ridiculous. And I brought up today, how could historians, first of all, most people don't even know what is going on in historical symposia and in historical history classrooms and history journals. Normal people don't read that stuff. Why would they be afraid that someone's going to find it, and then who's going to get Billy Graham's going to call and yell at them from, you know what I mean?
I'm laughing on the inside.
I know. I'm just trying to figure out, where could you even get this? Who would they even theoretically be afraid of if you had any evidence for this? And yet these people make this assertion like it's totally obvious. Don't be naive. And there's really no evidence at all for it. And yet these people are going along doing history. They have to submit the history to other historians. If they have a ridiculous ass bias, I'm sorry, Gerd, that is totally obvious,
it's
making them do shitty history, they're going to get laughed off the panel. They're going to get peer-reviewed into the ground, because this is not just one bunch of people. These are people from all over the world, you know, in many different disciplines of history, in all different cultures, and unlike, you hear these arguments all the time, it's just Christians to say this, like all historians are Christians, which of course they're not, and as you know, when you start reading historical scholarship, a lot of the people that are the loudest about mythicism are not Christians. Not that it
would
matter.
Yeah, the most prolific are mostly atheists or Jews. So, you
that's
know,
right.
With regard
that's,
to this
that's
topic.
Right.
So it's fucking hilarious that people are like,
right,
this obvious Christian bias.
The ones,
like,
yes,
give me a fuck.
And yet, the people that you're reading about this are not just accomplished historians who have done the things that you need to do in order to be able to evaluate historical information, but most of them aren't even believers. And they don't work for secular institutions. Where are you getting this crap?
You want to hear something actually? You want to hear something sort of humorous? So, so a while back, we were having a conversation with an author of a book that involves mythicism. Do you remember this conversation? This is pretty recent.
Exactly.
Right? It was like 3 weeks ago. Okay. And I actually, I had remembered something that I had read from Bertrand Russell when it came to positions on, you know, non-experts evaluating expert opinions and assessments. And, you know, funny enough, I ran across the actual quote, the first thing that popped up on Google whenever I typed it in was something from Jerry Coyne. The, you know, yeah, that's his name. Yeah, Jerry Coyne. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
He runs that blog. Yes, I did say that right. So Jerry Coyne had not too long ago, something that you and I think, had a brief conversation over was he was sharing a, you know, some mythicist nonsense on his blog, right, which is frequented by quite a few, you know, atheist, secularist people who are scientifically minded. You know, I mean, he's, you know, very, very popular inside of the atheist community. So it was so funny for him to be using arguments that were bad, like 2 years after he, you know, shared this, you know, Bertrand Russell, these rules Bertrand Russell kind of laid out, with regard to mythicism. And I'm going to read them real quick. So Bertrand Russell's rules for skeptics about consensus with regard to expertise. Number one, when the experts are agreed, the opposite opinion cannot be held to be certain. Number two, when experts are not agreed, no opinion can be regarded as certain by a non-expert. And number three, when experts all hold that no sufficient grounds for a positive opinion exists, the ordinary man would do well to suspend his judgment.
To shut up, yes, and to not decide that he knows, yes. Those are very relevant.
So that's the thing. In the case of mythicism, the experts are agreed. The experts are agreed. And therefore demonstrating that the opposite opinion cannot be held to be certain by other experts, by the way, who disagree.
Right, right.
So when
right.
So what he's saying is that when consensus exists, okay, the only people that are able to actually comment and try to attempt to refute the consensus are other experts, okay?
And here's why that matters. Right.
Go ahead.
Non-experts are not in the position to do that. No, the reason is I think people blow off history. Like, it's not, it's not science. It's not like I have to take microbiology. It's just words. I'm sure I can figure this out. If I read this thing, I'll be able to get it. It'll make sense. And then they read a thing that happens to already agree with what they suspect is true. The thing sounds very compelling. And I'm not condemning this. The first thing I read on this subject, and I said this before, was a mythicist book, and I found it very compelling. It sounded compelling. It was well written. And I thought, wow, that sounds like an open and shut case. But because I'm really tried hard to be a good skeptic, I actually kept on reading. And the fact that I keep arguing with people who admit they have read nothing but that, nothing but one thing or two things from the people that completely disagree with the overwhelming majority of historians, and they won't keep reading, and nobody's told me why. No one has said, well, here's why I won't read any actual historians except for, you know, A and B, because, there's no answer. There's just defensiveness about, oh, yeah, well, if he performed miracles, and of course, that's where we get into one of my favorite fallacies about this argument, which is there is no historical argument for Jesus's divinity. There are theological arguments. The apologists will come skating in and tell you why they think he rose from the dead because his tomb's empty. I mean, just whatever. All of that crap. That has nothing to do with this conversation, and I'm so tired of hearing it. So tired. Well, if he was healing all these people, then A, B, and C, and D, and E person would have come to get healed. Why didn't they even know about him? Because he wasn't healing anybody. That's not the argument. He was just a dude. wander around talking about how great he was and probably saying he was the Messiah and he had some faults. Now, all that stuff is not part of the core historical argument, but assuming that that's who the dude was, and that's what most historians would say, why would he be a big deal? There were tons of guys like that around. He got himself a donkey.
Right.
No one would notice. He's not Hannibal conquering a bunch of people.
Which, by the way, since you brought up Hannibal, let me use the mythicist argument, the
yes,
one that
please.
I hear so often. Well, you would expect that more would be written about him. Hannibal had one brief contemporary, brief, as in less than 100 words. Dude conquered most of what we would now know to be Italy. 100 words. Contemporary.
Yeah, well, what you think people would be... And here's another problem. I'm just going to launch into this next thing, if that's okay. We have
a serious problem here with
people assuming they're glomming their 21st century American context onto first century Galilee, and they're saying, well, of course, if this was that way, then you would expect that to be this way. Wrong! You cannot... This is why historical training matters. This is why it matters. Because you understand, you learn to understand what kind of culture you're studying. This is why when Americans go to Japan, they get totally confused. They understand, like, why am I telling this person really bad news and they're smiling and nodding at me? Why is that? It's because you don't understand the cultural context of that behavior. And it's not intuitive. You can't just assume, well, I'll figure it out. No, that's not how it works. You will never understand that unless you study it and figure. You can't even really ask the person because they won't know how to answer you in a way that will make sense to your own cultural framework. So you go into history and you learn Japan is high context, we are low context. Galilee, in the first century, high context culture. A lot of people don't even know what that means or why it matters. It matters a lot.
Right.
So you learn what that stuff is. You learn what the context of the, you know, what does an itinerant rabbi do in Galilee. Well, I don't understand. Well, you find that stuff out. You learn about mistakes that were made by historians before you and why things changed in the 19th century and why using, you know, early 19th century historians to try to prove shit now is ridiculous. The same thing, reason you wouldn't, and this does transfer, the same reason you wouldn't use early 19th century science to try to do an experiment right now. And while it's not quite as cut and dried, it is the same thing. It's because we've learned a ton since then. And you can explain what that is. So you have that. You have this all this stuff that you're learning that way. You have all this cultural stuff you have to learn. You can't just shove your idea of what should have been this one way or another into a different culture and a different, totally different time period and expect results to come popping out the way you want to see them. And then you start learning the languages. And as anybody who likes Kafka knows... Are you still there?
I'm listening.
Uh-oh. Oh, sorry. No, it was.
I was just letting you rant. Oh.
As anyone who likes Kafka knows, translation is a major bitch. You have to get someone that knows how to do it, or it's going to be terrible and suck. And you realize how different things are in translation. But when you actually learn Greek or Aramaic, and you can read source documents, you can read secondary documents, and then you can read what the German historical analysis was and why that was right or wrong. That stuff matters. And anybody who comes waltzing onto the scene and says, "Well, I saw this argument about A, B, and C, and have decided that since these people didn't talk about Jesus, well, he probably didn't exist." You completely ignore the entire. I mean, you're ignoring an entire academic discipline that is important. It is important to us as a species.
Right.
And you're pretending
it
doesn't make any fucking difference.
Right. So the number of people that I've actually met who are mythicists that have studied both sides of this argument, zero. None. Not a single person. Not a single person I've ever met, talked to, that has ever actually studied the same things, that I have. You know, when we were talking to that guy, the guy I'm talking about, that author dude, and he was like, oh, so, I pointed out that the for one, peer review in anything, whether it's history, it's humanities, or it's hard science, gives you the option, or gives you rather the opportunity to get your foot in the door. That's all it is. It means that, you know, the people who run the journal, run the press, you know, have given you the opportunity to put this out so that other experts can, you know, can either validate or invalidate your, you know, your claims. That's what it is. Peer review, for one, and there's this misunderstanding of what peer review is. Oh, I have a peer-reviewed article. Whoop-de-fucking-do. Was the article replicated? That's what scientists actually care about. What were the problems
right, and
with
what
the
did,
study?
What did the peer review say, though, too? You need to know what the peers reviewed it.
Correct. Which, by the way, you rarely ever find out. I mean,
right. Most
blind peer reviews, they typically just submit their issues with it, and then the author is given the opportunity to change certain things.
Right, to change.
And then it's submitted.
But sometimes they
right,
don't.
Right, and then it goes forward, which is, it's a great system, but just because something is fucking peer reviewed doesn't mean that it's correct.
No, and also, but also the reason that peer review still works, even though it's blind and even though, you know, stuff may not be corrected, is because when the stuff comes out, it then gets rebutted, not blindly, right? So then you read responses and rebuttals to it, and you evaluate those, you evaluate the thing based on that. All of that stuff is important. If you take any one thing out of this process and just decide, well, I'm just gonna go with that, you are derailing. A skeptic should be horrified about doing that, truly.
Right. So there's this big deal right now going on with this most recent book that Richard Carrier put out. I don't know Richard, by the way. I've heard good things about him. I've had people who have, you know, who I know, who I trust, I trust their judgments, and, you know, they've referred to him as being a very good man who, you know, is very active in social justice issues, things that I would most certainly agree with him on, anyway. But, you know, but I hear them use this that, oh, his recent book was peer-reviewed. What they don't know is that it was peer-reviewed by a group that is what is referred to in historical circles as being biblical minimalists, which means that they believe there's basically no, you know, valid history to the Old Testament, to the New Testament, to either parts of the Bible, which, you know, are demonstrably wrong.
Which, by the way, not at all what the majority assert, right?
Yeah, I mean, not at all true. Kenneth Kitchen wrote a wonderful book on this, on the reliability of the Old Testament, and, you know, he uses multiple sources from, you know, Sumerian sources, Egyptian sources, Persian sources, to demonstrate that some of the things in the Bible are actually pretty well documented, you know. Believe it or not, but most lay people are not going to research that.
Why would that?
Well, most lay people aren't going to research. Well, I don't know. I mean, Kitchen's book reads like fucking stereo instructions. Like, it's terrible. Like, I mean, I have to force myself to read it. You know, I mean, it just is. Like, there are graphs and demonstrations and that kind of thing, and it's like, oh my fucking God. You know, but at the same time, when you actually read through the sources and, you know, you go and you investigate the sources, you realize he's actually, you know, he's very accurate and he's very, very thorough. Thorough to the point that it gives you a fucking headache.
Yeah.
You know, but regardless, again, going back to the perspective of a non-expert, doesn't matter what I think. You know, historians who study the Old Testament, historians who, you know, have... you know, studied other regions, you know, sort of around Mesopotamia, have concluded that, for the most part, Kitchen is right. And, you know,
yeah. He
got that by being able to publish a book and then, you know, other experts kind of commented on it. Peer review gets your foot in the door. It doesn't mean that you have, you know, created a bulletproof argument. It just means that now they're willing to listen to your argument. And if you don't believe or accept, rather, the consensus, the factual consensus, that there are, you know, a plethora of valid statements in the Bible, of valid record-keeping inside of the Bible, then you don't really know the Bible. You know, there are these studies that come out all the time that demonstrate how much, you know, the atheists know the Bible, or secularists know the Bible, or agnostics know the Bible more than Christians and, you know, and some of these other groups. And by the way, Jews tend to beat everybody, including atheists and agnostics, typically. You know, the theology or the historicity.
Well, most of them have had to learn it in two languages.
Well, both the theology and the historicity is missed by most atheists, and that's because history is missed by most people. I mean, being an atheist does not grant you, you know, does not all of a sudden make you any more intelligent than anyone else. I mean, I was a Christian for 20 years, you know, and which I'm not trying to plagiarize this from Matt Dillahunty, but he's absolutely correct. And I'll just quote his words, you know, absolutely. I mean, you know, he basically said that, he didn't get smarter when he became an atheist. You know, he just, you know, realized or, you know, came to understand how to value evidence. And, you know, for me, when I became an atheist, I understood how to value evidence with regard to things that I believed and felt deeply, and realized that those beliefs and those feelings were wrong and had no justification and had no reason behind them. But, you know, when you look at the way mythicist arguments are worded and the way that they cherry pick their claims, it looks so similar to how creationists do the exact same thing. It just does.
No, it does. You're right. It does. And the people are out to get us, and that's why historians are, you know, afraid to whatever, all that stuff. One of my friends brought up to me today, he said, well, it's funny, if everyone's so afraid of angry Christians, why aren't the evolution people, like, pretending and lying? I mean, they're actually getting dragged into court.
That is a really good point.
It is. You'd think that they'd be really scaring the evolution people, but yet there they are, marching along, just doing science, just like the historians are doing history. And if anybody's wondering, like, you know, I'm better read about this subject, but nothing is stopping you from being better read about the subject. Honestly, I had to teach history in a basic way for about 10 years of the job, but I was not a historian. I am not now. This stuff is accessible to normal people. You can just start reading it. And some of it's really interesting. A lot of these people have written books that are accessible to people who don't understand all this history stuff. And if I stumbled onto this thing today that I thought was really great, it's this, it's an article by Tim O'Neill, who is, history is my thing. He's a history guy. And he has been writing a blog for a long time. And he happens to be an atheist, just in case you're already going in for the bias thing. But he wrote this great thing about the historical method and how it differs from the scientific method. And in case you don't know, which most of us don't, including me, exactly how history gets done and which parts of it and how things get evaluated for whether or not they're relevant and how bias gets evaluated and how all this stuff gets put together to form historical opinion, it's fascinating. And this thing takes 5 minutes to read. It's on the Strange Notions blog, which I think might be a Catholic blog. It's not relevant. The thing is, he's actually addressing atheists specifically. It's called Why History Isn't Scientific and Why It Can Still Tell Us About the Past. And it's really cool. It explains, like, the heuristic process and the critical process and the evaluative process, all the stuff that it seems like people are just randomly making assertions, but they're not. So if you don't get now why, you know, every historian's like, well, yeah, duh, of course he existed, then it's not hard to find out why. It's not a mystery. They're not just making some weird claim based on nothing. You can find out why they claim that.
No, and they're not just guessing either, which is completely and totally ludicrous. You know, something David said on this show when we interviewed him that really fucking irked me, and I didn't get a chance to address it because you two were fighting.
we were not fighting. We were having a spirited discussion.
When he basically said that, you know, well, biblical, you know, well, the life of Jesus it varies, you know, based on the scholar you're talking to. There are all these different theories. one thing has absolutely nothing to do with the other. For example,
no.
I don't know if Boudica liked the color black. That has no bearing on whether or not she actually existed. And by the way, Boudica led a, you know, led a revolt against the Romans in, you know, what we now know to be Britain. And she has no contemporaries. No contemporaries. Not a single one. And by the way, there are dozens of those throughout all of history. The contemporary argument is such a shitty and crappy one that anyone who actually uses it, I can tell they've never read a single book on history, period. I know you haven't.
Well, you'd have to
And the
try
way
out,
I know that is
you'd have to try
because you,
almost everybody.
Well, you would have to throw out your secondary characters. See, here's the thing. History
you have to throw
creates
your primary characters because you don't have before a certain time, you don't have contemporaries on all of those people either.
Well, you don't have contemporaries on all of them, but it's not like that's the only method. I mean, you know, you could use the argument either way. But for example, if I use David Fitzgerald's argument about the lack of contemporaries, I can make a similar case about Hannibal, and I could say that if he were so important, more historians from that time period would have written about him, and that Hannibal may not have existed given there, you know, was only the one scant reference to his existence. Despite the fact that the dude basically, you know, invaded and then captured an entire fucking continent. Excuse me, an entire country. On the other hand, on the other hand, I can also use that logic, and I can say the fact that he did have a contemporary who wrote about him must mean that he existed. I mean, it is a poor and pathetic and terrible argument, but many people use it because they don't fucking understand history. They don't understand the historical methods. They don't know anything about anything.
That's about history. The thing is, in this article I was talking to you about, Strange Notions, Tim O'Neill says the same thing, that a lot of us are stuck at pretty much high school grade history. But that's okay. Everybody is, unless you have been trained to do history. It doesn't make you an idiot. It doesn't mean like, oh, you're just fucking ignorant idiot. No, it doesn't. It is an easy mistake to make, especially reading something that already kind of goes along with what you think might be true, and it sounds really compelling, and they pile on all these examples of people who should have talked about Jesus but didn't, or whatever. There is no reason to feel like an asshole if you bought this argument. I don't feel like an asshole. I didn't step up and start arguing for this either because I hadn't read the other side of the argument. But even
you know
if
what's
you
hilarious?
Oh,
I want to jump in. Can I jump in?
No, go ahead.
You know what's fucking hilarious? It's when people say that, you know, so-and-so should have written about this guy. What the fuck are you basing that on?
Yeah, I ask that all the time. I never get
like,
an answer.
What are you basing that position on? That these people, by the way, when it's not a straw man argument, there was this guy going around and resurrecting dead people and shit. Well, obviously someone, you know, should have written about him. Well, fuck, when you put it like that, yeah, you have a good argument. But that's not the argument that we're having. That's not the conversation that historians are having. You have straw man. The entire conversation. So any attempt for me to address this with you, you know, is going to be met with another strawman argument that I'm sorry that you read in something pseudo-historical like Nailed. Sorry. There's a reason why. And I like David Fitzgerald very much. And, you know, and David and I agree on a lot of things. And I think David has done a lot of great things for secularism. David is not a historian. David doesn't even qualify as a scholar. David barely qualifies, unfortunately, well, depending on how you look at it, as an amateur. And,
no,
you know,
he is
being directed by Richard Carrier, who is a frequent Stapleton on, you know, Reddit's, you know, our bad history. Because he so regularly chooses his bias of being against Christianity to direct how he views history. There's a reason why Richard Carrier is not important in historical circles. There's a reason why Richard Carrier is only important inside of the secular community. And by the way, the same conspiracy theories about how, oh, yeah, you know, and I got told this, that, oh, there was this big pushback against his dissertation. No evidence. There are all these people who don't want him to publish this book. No evidence. You know, there's never any evidence. Skeptics demand evidence all the time, but they just take, you know, this guy at his word. It's fucking amazing. It is completely incredible that there is absolutely no intellectual honesty with regard to this. By the way, you can be an atheist and a skeptic and still care about the truth. And you can be an atheist and you can claim to be a skeptic and then you can bastardize the truth.
Or care about being right. And the thing is, I don't
think... Oh, there's
think...
a problem. There's a reason why people like Richard Carrier and David Fitzgerald do not write fucking books that are aimed at historians. There's a reason why. There's a reason why people think that because his book was peer-reviewed, that all of a sudden now, oh, now it's an authority. I could pull up peer-reviewed articles for anti-vaxxers. Does that make their position any more legitimate? No. Peer review gets
Look,
your foot in the door. It means someone is willing to take you seriously.
And here's the thing.
Oh,
and
by
I gotta
the
say
way,
about David. If anybody
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. We're already over, and I just want to make sure. Like, the thing about this is, like, I feel strongly about it because I feel like people aren't exercising their skepticism. If you read both sides of the argument, you still disagree with me, fine. Cool. But don't tell me, don't make this argument if you haven't read anything from in historical scholarship except for Carrier Price.
Well, I don't have to because the, you know, because the echo chamber that I live inside of tells me that I'm right about everything.
Right.
By the way,
so
if
the
you
thing,
believe
like,
you belong to a group, if you believe you belong to a group that is not wrong, that's
yeah,
on
you're
you,
you're in big
dude.
Trouble. That's pretty
yeah,
great.
Seriously,
so the
like,
is,
really?
Like,
they're never wrong about anything? I mean, David Silverman is a fucking idiot, but somehow he's president of American Atheists, so...
I can't comment on David Silverman because I don't really know him. But the point
I
is,
do.
Let me just go and say, if you want to be, if you're telling me you're a skeptic, then please read both sides of an argument before you make a case. If you've read it and you don't agree with me, fine. Neither of us are experts, and so my opinion on this actually doesn't matter. What I'm yelling about is the fact that, like, we're ignoring expert opinions en masse. I have heard so many, there are so few people that are even skeptical about this. They just hear it and buy it, and it's bumming me out. You got to be skeptical about stuff. You will buy any sack of shit that anyone hands you if you're not skeptical across the board. That doesn't mean you have to be a dick. It doesn't mean you have to be mean to people. Like, it just means, huh, that's an assertion. I should read more evidence about that and see which assertion seems like it goes along with the preponderance of the evidence. Or see if there's any gigantic hole in the argument I just read, even though it sounds really compelling. You don't have to agree
Sorry,
with me.
Darby, we're apologists. We're apologists for this entire
oh,
Christian
yeah.
conspiracy.
So,
you know, that
yeah,
is being,
because
you know,
I really care about that.
That
and,
is
and
being enforced.
Is,
yeah, that is being enforced by a bunch of, you know, historians, many of whom are not Christians. Sorry.
Yeah,
sorry you didn't know
yeah.
that.
Right.
By the way,
and
I
so,
can just name drop at any time and say that I'm being persecuted and, you know, never give any evidence for it and people just believe it.
And the thing is, I'm the reason I even care about this doesn't matter. Most of us are on the same page about the fact that the assertions of Christianity are ridiculous. It is ridiculous. We are talking about ascending bodily into heaven and rising from the dead. Come on, we all know that's crap. But we can tell you why that's crap. You can say why that's crap. It flies in the face of science. This assertion flies in the face of history. And yet, so many people are looking at me like, oh, well. And then I hear this, oh, yeah, well, contemporary argument. And it all comes out. So you know, don't take I'm not an expert, and neither is Jared. Don't take our word for it. Just read about it. If you don't agree with us,
nope.
then fine. And the thing is, I'm happy to have civil discussions with people. I enjoy talking to David. I'm reading his book about Mormonism now, and I'm really enjoying it so far. Awesome. But I don't agree with him about that thing. We can still speak civilly about
it. I think David's a great author. I think David's a great author. I think he's very wrong with regard to this. Okay, hey, we got to go.
I know, we're way over time. Thanks for listening to us rant, everybody.
We are.
It's important. Skepticism is important.
All right. By the way, we're going to be changing. We're going to be changing the show. It's no longer going to be live. We're going to be doing podcasts. We're still working out the details of that. We're going to be doing the Thursday show every week until we get that worked out. So we still got to work on the specifics of that thing. You know, you and I kind of work out.
But people have actually asked us for a podcast, so we're going to give those to you. There you go.
Yeah, instead of doing the live radio show, it seems like the podcast might be a little bit better and give us a little bit more time. And, you know, we both have very, very demanding schedules. So, you know, doing this on Thursday, sometimes we kind of throw it together. But the podcast will give us the ability to have a little bit more freedom, creative freedom.
And people can download it because we have been asking, it has been asked by, a very small number of people if there's a podcast they can download. So now that will be available for you very soon.
Right. Which is true. So, you've been listening to Logicast. We will be on next week talking about Zeus Knows What. We're on every Thursday, 8 o'clock p.m. Central Standard Time, 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll see you next week.
All right. See you. Bye.